What do we mostly pray for? And we all pray. We got up this morning, Sabbath morning, and we want to spend some extra time in prayer, in meditation. And sometimes we have meditative prayers, even in addition to the time that we spend on our knees in praying. And I think an important question is, what do we pray for, mostly? What is the focus of our list of things that we have to pray for? I got the idea for this sermon, of all places, from an archery magazine. And you wonder, what in the world does that have to do with prayer? Well, it was an interesting one. It was about two old guys, older than me, so they're definitely old guys. They were in their mid-60s. This only happened a couple of years ago, so they were in their, well, actually, they were late 60s, 68, I think, one and 67, if I'm not mistaken. But they were tall, lanky men who were pretty fit, lifelong friends. And they decided that for fun, they would go to Alaska and have a pilot fly their raft in up a river about 6 miles past where he could land and drop the raft. Literally fly low and dump it out. And so he did, sort of bombed a sandbar with a raft. It was all wrapped up and everything. Then he went back and got the two hunters and flew them in 6 miles downriver from the raft. Now, you know, 6 miles in a mountain, basically, downriver from the raft. They had to carry 100-pound packs to get to the raft. Those were their supplies. And then they would hunt their way down the river. Well, they hunt up by the raft first for a while, for a few days, and then they float out. That was how they'd get out to civilization again. So you've got two old guys doing that, and they're hunting with bows and arrows. They have firearm backup because there are grizzlies and black bears in the neighborhood, and in fact, they had episodes where they very narrowly missed a serious head-to-head with a grizzly. Very narrowly. And not so narrowly, missed one with a cantankerous black bear, which are normally not cantankerous, or not as cantankerous as a grizzly. So they got to talking. They're both the, you know, Christian types. There's a Christian Bow Hunters Association that they're actually active members in. And so they are the kind of men, maybe they don't understand God's truth, but they certainly take their religion seriously. And they had a philosophy about prayer. They never pray for gifts. They pray for something else. You know, you could, God, give me a big moose. One had a moose tag, the other had a caribou tag. And, you know, give me a caribou. You know, you could pray like that if you were in their boat. But no, they ask for something else. And I think there's an interesting piece of advice in it. They ask for wisdom, for guidance. Guide me to a moose, you know, and a caribou. And protection. That's where the bears come in. Well, the moose, too, because mooses tend to have, is it mooses or is it meese? Mouse, mice, mouse. Anyway, it's mooses. The moose can be a little bit cantankerous when you surprise them up close. They're big, you know, they weigh 1,500 pounds, and they get the big headgear on there. So they didn't pray that God would just give them what they came for. They just prayed that he would give them protection, that he would guide them, and he would give them wisdom. And I thought, wow, that's profound. Now, I like to read this archery magazine and a couple of others, but most of them are about shooting arrows and making bows and, you know, things like that, but not that profound. So I had to mull it over. And I decided, you know, there's some lesson, there's a good piece of wisdom, literally, for us here today. Particularly as we get ready for the Passover season. We're not far away from that. What better time is there than to overhaul our prayers appropriately? Now, we don't have to face angry moose. And caribou aren't as dangerous. They tend to run away from you. But sometimes when they're running away from you and you're in the way, they can be dangerous. And bear in mind, they were, I don't know, 50 miles away from civilization, no roads, just the river was the road. See, when they got done getting the moose and the caribou and hauled the meat to camp and got it all, well, they had to share some of the caribou with the grizzly bear. You know, that goes with the territory, I guess. Bear insisted. Then they loaded it all up in their big raft, and they floated down the river and almost capsized it twice on strainers. Strainers are trees that fall into the river, and they create an eddy that if you get too close to them, it can pull your craft either in underneath, which is one of the main things, and kind of strains you off of it and holds you underwater till you can't breathe anymore. You don't want to go where there are strainers if you're a rafter or a boater, for that matter, on a swift river. And this was a swift one. So you can see why the protection part of their prayer came in, is they hit one of the strainers, and one of the men was strained out of the boat. And when he managed to pull himself up out of the water, because he was, even though he was older, he was strong, and got to shore, that's when he had the episode with the black bear. Because the black bear was between him and where his buddy got the raft around the bend of the river and off to the side, and it was a pretty exciting story, you know, when you get down to it. We have some pretty exciting times that we live in. Let's consider our times. When we think about praying for wisdom, guidance, and protection, sometimes you need a little motivation for your prayers. Let's turn to Jeremiah chapter 30. Now, here's a proverb, a prophetic proverb, I guess you could say it is, in many respects. It's a prophecy. Chapter 31, of course, is more famous for having the New Covenant prophecy in it. But chapter 30 has one that has to do with the time before the New Covenant becomes a wholesale event. And while it's still, you know, one or two here and there as the church is today. Now, these are the words that the Lord spoke concerning Israel and Judah. Verse 4. For thus says the Lord, we have heard a voice of trembling, of fear, and not of peace. Ask now and see whether a man is ever in labor with a child. No. But then why do I see every man with his hands on his loins like a woman in labor, and all faces turned pale? Why do I see the fear in the eyes of those in the population that would normally be brave? Why do I see that? Then we come to the kicker verse. Alas, for that day is great, and so that none is like it. And it is a time of Jacob's trouble. A time of Jacob's trouble. Now, when it says that day is great and none is like it, that language connects to Matthew 24. By the way, we're going there shortly. And a couple of other places, Daniel 12 as well. Talking about the end of the age will be a time of trouble that is unparalleled in human history. Like there has never been since there has been a nation, nor will there ever be again. And we're floating our raft right down to that white water filled with strainers and waterfalls and nasty sharp rocks and bears lining the shores with their mouths watering. That's pretty much the world situation. A time of Jacob's trouble. By Jacob's trouble, that means specifically a time of particular trouble for the nations descended from Jacob, i.e. the 12 tribes of Israel, Israel and Judah. The United States qualifies in that category as being one of the premier ones descended from the tribe of Manasseh. England, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, descended from Ephraim, and various other nations in Northwest Europe that are descended from some of the other tribes. A time of Jacob's trouble. That's the time that we are floating straight into. Challenging times indeed. You know, Timothy was told by Paul that and this is for your reference, it's 2 Timothy 3 and verse 1. You know it, we won't turn there because I want to go to Isaiah next, but that in that spot in Timothy, it says, this know also that in the last days there will be perilous or dangerous times. Well, we are in dangerous and perilous times. Now, we all came here to services without, you know, major problems, a little bit wet roads. Some rivers are high, and so there'll be a few roads you can't take here in Ohio, and similar things elsewhere. Probably a blizzard's blowing somewhere in the west of the United States or Canada, and other brethren will be facing other challenges. But we can, you know, we're functioning reasonably well at the moment. But for those who are watching what's happening in the world, the trends are not good. The civil unrest across North Africa and into the Arab world are significant. Not in the sense of significance and as in various rulers will be given the royal boot out of office or the non-royal boot, depending on which they deserve, as the case might be, but because the region is destabilized. And Europe runs on the fuel that comes from there. We do to a certain degree as well, but America has resources that haven't even been developed that makes all those resources look small. But Europe doesn't have those resources. Their fuel comes from under the sands of the Middle East. That puts them in a precarious position. When the United States cut off Japan from its fuel sources in Indonesia and other places, at the beginning of World War II, Japan had to make war within about 6 months, or they would not have the ability to make war. They had to open up those sea channels to get that fuel for their ships and things, or else they would simply have to give up. At that time, they weren't of a mind to give up. And thus we have that other theater of World War II. That was a perilous time. A very perilous time for many people in many countries, but it will be, this one coming will be significantly more. Let's go back to Isaiah chapter 3. And it's not just the dangers of the events in Egypt, and now in Libya, and the fact that that's spreading around to other areas. It's not just the threat of terrorism, which increases greatly. You know, we haven't had any nuclear terrorism yet. We've had movies about it, but we haven't had it yet. That's always possible, you know. There are all kinds of dangerous bottlenecks in our society. We are so dependent upon electricity that if that's cut off, a grid is, you know, and I don't mean a local cutoff. I'm talking about a complete grid breakdown of the electrical system in huge sections of America or any other country. Then it gets very dicey, very precarious, very quickly. You think, well, I'm okay, I got a credit card. No, you don't, because you can't use a credit card. It depended on electricity to be connected to via the telephone to all the places that electrically read your credit card so that you can charge for your fuel. And then how are you going to pump it out of the tanks if there's any left in the tank under the grocery store filling station, which is where the filling stations more are today? And you start thinking about these things, you can scare yourself really well. It's like facing a grizzly bear. I did that one time. It was at one of our camps in the Tetons in Wyoming. This was a few years ago. And two of us had driven the vans that hauled the campers to their trailhead, and they were going to go backpacking for 3 days. So we followed them up. We go to where they have lunch. It was a 3.5-mile hike up to a pass. I think it was Fox Pass or something like that. Fox Pass was very innocuous. The trail up there went through Death Canyon. Oh, man. The perfect name for what we were facing. On the way back down, because everybody was fine, they got sick after we left. Actually, a couple of them did, but everybody was fine by the time we got there. So we're hiking down, just marching the 3.5 miles out to where the vans were parked. And, you know, there are other hikers from other, you know, just regular hikers in the Tetons at the time. Or we came, but we hadn't met any. We'd come down the trail off the scree field, the scattered rocks, and into the big timber at the bottom of Death Canyon. And I walked around the trail, ran around a tree, and it was a good-sized fir tree, maybe 2-3 feet in diameter at the base. And then the trail straightened out, which was rare. Mostly it zigzags. But it straightened out for about 30 yards. And around the tree at the other end stepped a grizzly bear. And I stopped and looked at him. And he stopped and looked at me. And I went for my gun, and he went for his and dropped it because he didn't have an opposable thumb. No, that's not what happened. A little fun with you there. I didn't have a gun. I had a video camera on a little aluminum tripod. Now, that's a serious protection against a bear. Get back or I'll take your picture. I was supposed to be the carnivore expert at the camp, and I'd done my study, and I looked at the bear, and I thought, black bear or grizzly, blonde. And no blonde jokes are used on bears. But there's a color phase of grizzlies called blonde. Well, interestingly, rarely does it happen, but in the Tetons it does happen. You have blonde color phases of black bears. And we'd actually seen one only a couple of days earlier. So I'm looking at a grizzly bear or black bear. Because he was standing slightly broadside with his head, swinging his head back and forth. Fortunately, they can't see very well. The wind was coming from him to us. So I looked at his hips and I thought, well, I can't tell. How are you supposed to tell that? I said, well, then I went out, look for the hump. Grizzlies have a hump over their shoulders. They're real high on the shoulders. And it sloped slightly up, but I couldn't say that there was a hump. And this is all taking place in less than half a second, processing all these thoughts. Then I looked, okay, look at the head. If the ears look big, it's a black bear, small skull, because the ears are the same size in both kinds of bears. If the ears look tiny, then it's a grizzly bear because of the big skull. The ears look tiny. Oh, that's not good. And about that time, he took one more step forward. I thought, that's really not good. He's supposed to go away, not toward me. So I said, okay, so what do I tell? This is still, we're only a 3/4 of a second after the first sighting. As you process all these thoughts, the three strategies, be big, be loud, be brave. All right, how am I going to be big? And I had this little tripod in my hand. I thought, well, I'll just wave my hands way slowly above my head, and then a tripod will kind of capture his attention in the right hand. And so I did that. And he held his head back for a minute, but he didn't budge. And I waved my arms up slowly like this to try to give the impression of being giant, And he wasn't impressed. I thought, whoa, that's not good. He's supposed to be impressed. Now, all right, if big isn't good enough, then you have to also be loud. So I thought, all right, I better yell at him. But what am I going to yell? I said, what do you yell at a grizzly bear to, sort of intimidate him? And I had no idea. Whatever comes out is what it's going to be. Well, what came out was, hoo-ha! I have no idea why hoo-ha. Well, I do too, because I used to hunt elk with a bow and arrow, so you get out in the elk woods in the summer, or in the spring, the fall, early fall, when the rut's on, you can bugle. And I learned to bugle with my voice rather than with a call, and it requires a great deal of diaphragm effort, which makes you sound a whole lot bigger than you really are. So the hoo-ha sounded pretty good. I was impressed. It was almost like the hoorah of, the U.S. Marines. So I started yelling that at him, and after hollering about five times and continuing to wave my arms, he took his step back. I thought, well, that's good progress. And he swung his head at me some more, sort of glowering through his eyebrows. And then he turned and he went down toward the river. We could hear the river down deeper in the canyon of Death Canyon. So that was a big sigh of relief when that happened. I looked over my shoulder at it was Amy Allwine, who is in the Minneapolis church, was behind me, about 10 feet behind me. And I noticed, oh, she's putting her running shoes on. I said, what, are you going to outrun the bear? She says, no, all I have to do is outrun you. she wasn't really. But anyway, our eyes must have looked like saucers. The bear wasn't especially scared. He just decided he wasn't hungry and went away. We hoo-hawed for about 100 yards down the trail till we were well past that spot. And every time we bumped into hikers coming the other way, we warned them about what we'd seen and to be on the lookout. So, the dealing with the fright of what these two bow hunters did in fact come across, grizzly and black bear, is really a good analogy for the kind of trouble that the world is having today. And it's not just violent trouble, but there's another kind of trouble, and that's moral trouble that the nation in America and all the nations are in. Isaiah 3 really begins to get into that. It says in verse 8, "For Jerusalem stumbled, and Judah is fallen, because their tongue and their doings are against the Lord, to provoke the eyes of His glory." And Jerusalem is often a term that takes in, because it was the capital of all Israel under David and Solomon, takes in by extension, the speaks of all the tribes, especially when you have, in conjunction with that, Judah mentioned specifically afterwards. "For Jerusalem has stumbled and Judah has fallen because their tongue and their doings are against the Lord." You know, we live in an age that claims that God doesn't exist. Vociferously claims it. And then they follow on the logical conclusion of atheistic belief, in that the conclusion is there is no moral law, no moral code of any kind. Therefore, whatever you want to do is okay. And that's how they operate, isn't it? That's their doings of our society today. "The look on their countenance witnesses against them." The countenance is the face. "And they declare their sin as Sodom, and they do not hide it. Woe to their soul, for they have brought evil upon themselves." Their sexual immorality is one of their primary pursuits. That is the condition of this nation and so many others, especially those descended from the tribes of Israel. And you stop and think about it, they know better. They have a heritage of the Bible. They know what the Ten Commandments say. You know, that knowledge is not completely foreign to them by any means, and yet they reject it. So as we size up our times, we see both physical and spiritual and moral danger that the world is facing. And now we go to Matthew 24. And by the way, remember what we're doing is analyzing what we need to pray for, what needs to be a primary aspect of our prayers. And that's wisdom, guidance, and protection. In Matthew 24, which is a pivotal chapter in the Bible, maybe in New Testament certainly, but in the Bible in many ways, we have all these challenges that we are facing now. And Jesus said to them in verse 4, and this is a prophecy that he gave from the Mount of Olives, hence it's often called the Olivet prophecy, named after the Mount of Olives. The Mount of Olives is immediately to the east of Jerusalem, and there's a canyon that runs, a steep, deep canyon that runs down between the Mount of Olives and the Temple Mount. And when you get on top of the Mount of Olives, you're slightly higher than the Temple Mount, and you can actually look down into the compound where presently the Dome of the Rock and the Alaska Mosque and so on are established or are built. So it's always been slightly higher. That deep valley between is the Valley Kidron that David spoke of so many times. The Kidron Brook or stream flows at the very bottom of it. So this Christ is on top of there. They're looking back. The disciples are with him. They're looking back across the canyon at Jerusalem and at the temple particularly. In his day, it wasn't the Dome of the Rock and the Alaska Mosque, which are Islamic holy places. It was the temple and the expanded Temple Mount that King Herod had built. So it was God's temple then. And it was a massive, beautiful place. And the limestone that it was all constructed from was still relatively fresh, only a few years old. Consequently, it was very bright. It tends to be white in most times when it's brought out of the soil, or very light colored. And then in the sun, it will age to sort of a golden patina over, you know, considerable length of time. But at this time, it was still very bright. And even when it ages, it's still quite bright. So Jesus is telling them, they want to know, what's it going to be when you're ready to return? What will be the signs of your coming? What do we look for? They thought he was coming back real quickly, you know, a couple of months, a few years maybe at the most. And they found out later, no, it was going to be some time ahead, the time in which we live. "Take heed," he said, "that no man deceives you." This is in verse 4. "For many will come in my name saying that I am a Christ, and will deceive many." So there will be many false messiahs, and there will be many religions proclaiming Christ as Messiah, but inaccurately proclaiming Him as Messiah. That can be applied in several ways. And many will be deceived, and certainly we have seen traditional Christianity take root in place of true Christianity of old, except for the remnant of God's people that he has always maintained. And you will hear of wars and rumors of wars. And that's what we hear now, wars and rumors of wars. We hear them better now than the ancients did because we have better television reception. Theirs was lousy. It was so lousy that nobody bothered to buy TV sets back then, which is why we never find any in archaeological digs. Of course, they hadn't been invented, I jest. See that you are not troubled, for all these things must come to pass, but the end isn't yet. So we're going to have those kind of troubles. Nation will rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom. You know, battles going on here, battles going on there. And there will be famines. And you think, well, we haven't had a famine yet. Well, we actually did. Remember the food shortage of rice and the riots in China and several other countries only 2 or 3 years ago? And you think, well, we really haven't had famines, you know, in our time. Well, I tell you what, when I was my teens, we had the famine in Biafra. We've had a famine in Chad. And basically, those famines in Africa weren't because of food or of crop failures. Some of them are crop failures exacerbated by rival tribes that use the crop failures to starve out their competition. And you think, well, that's really nasty. Well, Stalin did that with the White Russians at the end of World War II. He starved directly by his policies in Soviet Russia, 2.5 million White Russians in the Ukraine. Jolly fellow. So we've had famines. In our time, we will have more. Russia has just had a massive wheat crop failure. That's not good. The last time they really had a serious one of those was about 1972, and America supplied them with the grain. And then the joke on the street of Moscow was that, well, you know, the reason that we have so little bread in our stores is because there's a famine in America and we're sending wheat to help them. It was just the other way around, but that was the way the Soviets presented the truth. That was the tactic of the Marxist regime at that time. Not surprising by any means. It's generated by human thinking and human nature. There will be famines and pestilences. Oh, we've had pestilences. HIV, AIDS, that's been a pestilence. The Ebola, SARS, and who knows what other things are lurking that can get going. You know, the ones that they worry about the most is flu. The Spanish flu killed, 40 million people in 1918? You know, just when they got done fighting World War I, they lost so many people to the Spanish flu in the world population that it made World War I look kind of like a skirmish. You know, so how do you combat things like the Spanish flu and other viruses that we aren't able to get on top of, or the medical science isn't able to be? Now, we live in a precarious condition. You know, by the grace of God, we survive. And we thrive. Earthquakes in various places. Well, isn't it nice to know we haven't had any earthquakes recently? Our newspaper up in Columbus, over the past few years, they have an earth update. And so every week it shows up on one particular day. It's up in the upper corner of the second page. The earth update shows where all the earthquakes have taken place, and tsunamis, which usually are accompanied by earthquakes or generated by them. But we're having all of those things, and these are just the beginning of sorrows. It really gets going after that. And they will deliver you to tribulation, so we talked about persecution, and false prophets will arise, so even more false religion, and accept that this is opportunistic false prophets. And then in verse 12, and because lawlessness will abound, the love of many will grow cold. And we see that trend already happening. People are so preoccupied with things and stuff and self that they overlook anybody else. I've always noticed that Ohioans are very friendly people, except when they want to change lanes. They don't bother to tell you they're going to change the lane. They just change. No signals. Way too often. Having driven in a lot of states over the years, I've never seen anything like that. So I just expect that they all want to change lanes at any particular time and drive accordingly. But they don't show that courtesy. Well, it's hard, you know. You got your left hand stuck to your ear, talking on the cell phone, at least you're not texting, and how you run the turn signal? With your knee? No, they're running the steering wheel with their knee so that they can get their coffee while they talk on the phone, going at high speed. Don't ever drive like that. There are too many who do. But he who endures to the end shall be saved. Ah, that's good news. There is a way to survive. Endure to the end. And the gospel of this kingdom will be preached in all the world as a witness to all nations, and then the end will come. And be actively involved in promoting and proclaiming the gospel of God's kingdom. And that is what we are about in the United Church of God. To get the gospel of the kingdom out to the world as a witness. So even when we aren't getting as many responses to programs, literature, and other things as we would like, we always want to hear more, we know that we are fundamentally reaching the world as a witness. And we're constantly trying to make that even more effective, to get through the consciousness. All that the responses provide are, you know, potential new disciples. But it gives us a read that we are striking a nerve here and a nerve there. And getting through to people's thinking. And believe me, we are, because we've noticed that, because so many who have, in so many areas, just over the past couple of months, have begun to contact the church, to attend church, to want to know more about what they're reading and about what they're hearing and what they're watching on the program. We live in exciting times indeed, but times that are dangerous, needless to say, when you look at that. Roll over the pages to Luke 21 and verse 36, if you would, please. Luke 21. Now, it's a parallel to Matthew 24, Luke 21 is. Luke covers most of the same things, but not in as much detail as Matthew did in a couple of instances, and adds a little bit as well. And at the end of it, Christ gives an admonition. He says, "Watch, therefore, and pray always, that you may be counted worthy to escape all these things that will come to pass, and to stand before the Son of God." Watch and pray. But how do you pray? What do you pray for while you are watching the dangerous times in which we live? You pray for wisdom, guidance, and protection. Now, you're going to add into that, prayers specifically for people's healings and advancement of the work. Well, we need the wisdom to advance the work of God. So let's look at those three things: wisdom, guidance, and protection. Wisdom, first of all. The primary term used in the Bible for wisdom is found in Proverbs chapter 1. So we go to Proverbs chapter 1. The first seven verses are an introduction to the book. And it's the very first place that wisdom occurs is in verse 2. And that word there in the Hebrew is chachmah. Except it, when they spell it in English letters, it's C-H-O-C-H-M-A-H. Sounds like chachmah. But it's the way they start the word with H. It has sort of a C-H sound to it a little bit. That is the key word for wisdom, chachmah. And when you read about it and look at the dictionary definitions of what it means in Hebrew and so on, it has been described as the knowledge of those truths which lead to the knowledge of God. I mean, getting to understand and to know God in detail. It doesn't mean that the knowledge of those truths that just lead to knowing that God exists. It goes beyond knowing that to actually knowing God. Certainly God's law is a reflection of that. In the writings class at ABC that I'm covering right now, we've been going through the Proverbs. We just finished that. We just went through what we call the hierarchy of wisdom. Essentially, the law of God, two great commandments, and then the Ten Commandments, and then the statutes and the judgments, and then the prophets. That's the hierarchy. All of God's truth is wisdom. To love God above all things and love your neighbor as yourself, the two great commandments, that is the essence of wisdom. So when you say God is love, you are summarizing what wisdom really is. We want to be like God. God is love. We want to be love too. Not to just be loved, but to love. And to be love itself. So that is the great wisdom. The knowledge of those truths that lead to the knowledge of God. One Jewish commentary says it's the Sonsino Jewish commentary, actually. It is not sagacity, or, you know, the wisdom of the great philosopher types. It's not sagacity or abstract learning or philosophical speculation. That is not what the Proverbs are. That's not what wisdom is. God's wisdom isn't like that. And you can go and watch and read the meanderings of the great philosophers over time. From Ralph Waldo Emerson, we saw a bronze bust of his on the Antiques Roadshow the other evening. So now I have an idea of what he looked like. And he was sort of a modern American philosopher, a relatively modern American philosopher. But you can go all the way back through time into whatever nation there have been philosophers. And they speculate about this and speculate about that and go on ad infinitum on one topic or another. And when you get done, you aren't sure what it was they were talking about. And I'm not sure they're sure. In fact, I'm fairly sure that they're not sure. And I say that with a certain amount of surety. God's wisdom isn't like that. God's wisdom is understandable. It has a practical application, and the applying of that wisdom helps you understand God better. Wisdom is, as it goes on to say, an understanding of the principles which control and direct human living at its highest and best. Directs human living at its highest and best. Wisdom is essentially the way of life. God's wisdom, then, therefore, as we deduce from the definitions in the Sonsino commentary, God's wisdom is practical and pragmatic, readily applied at any particular time. And actually, the concept of Chokhmah carries with it, because of the words it's derived from, a practical skill or skillful living. We use the term skill sets and things like that that people have, and being skillful on this or that. It is an ability. Let me give you an example in the practical sense, in the hands-on sense, so to speak. In Exodus chapter 35, of the same word, but applied to two particular fellows. One was of the tribe of Judah, and another was a Danite. And someday we'll see how talented they were. But nobody knows where the Ark of the Covenant is right now. It's Exodus. Actually, the assignment for these two men is in chapter 31, at the beginning of the chapter. But we're looking at chapter 35 toward the end, beginning, in fact, in verse 30. And Moses said to the children of Israel, "See, the Lord has called by name Bezalel, the son of Uri, the son of Hur, of the tribe of Judah. And he has filled him with the Spirit of God in wisdom," and that's Chokhmah, "in Chokhmah and understanding, in knowledge and all manner of workmanship, to design artistic works, to work in gold and silver and bronze, in cutting jewels for setting, in carving wood, and to work in all manner of artistic workmanship." That was called wisdom. Now, considering the fact that it was Bezalel and the next one we're going to read about, their job was to design and construct the Ark of the Covenant, the Tabernacle of Meeting, which was the portable temple, and so many of the other items that God required for the Levitical priesthood and the acts, worship services that were conducted by them. When you read from chapter 31 forward, these two men were not involved in the rebellion of the golden calf. There's no evidence of that at all. You know, God already knew they were tried and true, it would appear. And he gave them particular gifts. And he put it in his heart an ability to teach in him. So not only could Bezalel work in all these different mediums of art and design, but he could teach others how to do it. And Aholiab, the son of Ahishamach of the tribe of Dan. So we have Bezalel and Aholiab. And he has filled them with skill to do all manner of work of the engraver and of the designer and of the tapestry maker and blue, purple, scarlet thread and fine linen and of a weaver and those who do every work and those who design artistic works. Now they worked with teams of artisans among the tribes of Israel at the time, out in the wilderness. They were in the wandering times when this took place, to construct the tabernacle, the Ark of the Covenant, and all the other items that God wanted them to do. That was Shachma. When you apply the principle and the phenomenal artistic skill, you think these people were real masters in precious metals, gold and silver, and in jewels. They could set the jewels in such a way, and they could work with tapestry and with linen, which would have to do with making canvas and you know the cloth that would be part of the covering for various things, and all of the other, and they could work with any kind of wood. They're phenomenal. Everything that there was to work in, they could do it. They knew how to do it, and they could teach it to others, so others could do it. And, boy, those were masters. People talk about artists who were called the Dutch masters, you know, at the particular time in art history. Well, and they were pretty remarkable, and other artists have been remarkable, too, in painting pictures, but these men were remarkable in such a multiplicity of ways. Phenomenal skill. Now, apply that thinking to skill in living the right way. If we could be like Bezalel or Aholiab in using God's wisdom in our lives, knowing when to say just the right thing, knowing how to do just the right thing that needs to be done, knowing how to circumvent our own selfish natures to reach out to serve others and love God above all. If we could just do that, we could have a Shachma like Bezalel and Aholiab. But there's another word for wisdom back in Proverbs, and the word is Haskel. I don't know if you ever remember the TV show a long time ago. They say there are reruns on nowadays of Leave It to Beaver. Well, Beaver's older brother, Wally, had a best friend, and his name was Eddie Haskell, which is Haskel. Same word, basically. H-A-S-K-E-L in English letters. That's in the book of Proverbs. Let's see, it's verse 3, I think. Where that is, I should have left a marker in the book of Proverbs. This is another, it's just simply called wisdom here. But it's another word, and the translation can also be rendered wise dealing, which carries with it the concept of insight. Now, sometimes we tend to think of wisdom as more of that, the insight, to look into something and get the meaning of it, whether it's a statement or actions or whatever, a project, to understand the inside meaning, have an insight, to look into it. As the commentary I was quoting from before said, it is a reader will be taught how to acquire the discipline which will enable him to perceive and live perceive the line of conduct that is just and right. See, when you want to do the right thing, you have to be able to figure out what the right thing is to do. Most of the time, it's obvious. The Sabbath, keep the Sabbath. If the annual holy days, keep the annual holy days. Go to the feasts. Those are pretty obvious. But in our interpersonal relations, knowing how to say the right thing, knowing when to say, you know, I need to just go and help my family do this project. You know, whatever it was I wanted to do, that can be later if there's time for it. You know, knowing the right and perceiving the line of conduct that's just and right. It means to be circumspect and thus to be skillful with intelligence or a discipline of skill. It's an applied skill in that sense. Very similar to Shachma, but it has this concept of insight woven into it. Applied skill, such as that of an artist to a musician, wisdom affects living in the same way that the skills of artists affect their crafts. And that's another commentary, the Nelson Bible Study Bible commentary describes that. Well, let's look just at an example in the book of Proverbs. It's one you probably know by heart. It's in Proverbs 15 and verse 1. See if you remembered what it said before you look at it. A soft answer turns away wrath. When somebody comes at us angry, we have a tendency to bristle and to snap back. But when you circumvent that tendency and you remember a soft answer turns away wrath, and you answer peacefully and softly, virtually always it diffuses the tension the other person is experiencing and makes them happier, and it makes the situation much more manageable. So it doesn't escalate into an argument. It de-escalates into solving the problem, whatever it is. So being able to step in and cut off your natural reaction of snapping back and giving a soft answer instead is a skill, a remarkable, wonderful skill, an applied skill. So that's the Haskell, true life skills. Again, they both have to do with skill, but it's skill in living, and it involves lots of practical things like Bezalel had. But you can learn wisdom from even those. Now, there's one more word that we need to understand about wisdom, and it's right here in Proverbs chapter 1 as well. It's in verse 5. This is a fun one because it shows a couple of additional items. Chapter 1 of Proverbs, verse 5. And it is the one called wise counsels. A wise man will hear and increase in learning, or increase learning rather, and a man of understanding will attain wise counsel. So as you begin to learn and apply Shakma and Haskell, you will ultimately attain or rise to having wise counsels at your command. Now, there's an interesting word that is used there in the Hebrew. The word is pronounced Takbulah, T-A-C-H. This is the English letters, obviously. T-A-C-H-B-U-L-A-H. T-A-C-H-B-U-L-A-H. Takbulah, wise steerings. It comes from the Hebrew word for sailor. How many here in Cincinnati have ever sailed anything? A sloop, for instance? Wow, quite a few. Do you know, therefore, how to sail into the wind? Because you can't always just sail where the wind wants to take you, because sometimes you need to go the other way. And being a landlubber that I grew up being in South Dakota, I had no clue how in the world you could possibly sail into the wind. Sailors all know it. You zigzag by moving your sails. You enable to put them at an angle where the wind is coming at you, but it's actually blowing you slightly into the wind. And so you zigzag to this side of the lake, and after a while you make a turn and you zigzag the other way, throwing your sails back around so they catch the wind blowing at you, but with the aid of the rudder, it's pushing you into the wind at a slight angle. And they zigzag into the wind. And every one of those turns is called a tack. That's called tacking. And it comes from the same root as Takbulah. Hebrew and English are not that far apart, and linguistic studies have proved that time and again. It literally means steerings, hence the discernment to steer a right course through life, as the Jewish commentary comments. Practical moral spiritual skill in making right decisions to steer through life. So we need to pray for this kind of wisdom, summarized by these three words. To make wise and right decisions in life, to avoid dangerous areas, to know how to deal with dangerous times as we are living in them. We need to pray for wisdom to be frugal, to be thrifty, and to budget effectively because we live in tough economic times. We need to pray for wisdom to be fruitful spiritually and to avoid all the pitfalls that are around us, sinful entertainments and things like that. But we also need God's divine guidance. Now, the two bow hunters we started talking about needed wisdom on how to deal with the grizzly bears. They found with the grizzly that the soft answer kind of turned away his wrath. And then they were They were prepared. One had the monster handgun out, and the other one carried a 12-gauge shotgun. But they didn't want to shoot the bear. And they decided, you know, if you really like that hunk of caribou meat, I guess we're willing to share. And they backed away without the bear charging, which would have meant either the death of them or the death of the bear, which would have meant the death of the bear. So they used wisdom in dealing with that particular situation. But in order to have gotten the caribou and then to get their moose and then to get out of there, they needed guidance, and we need guidance. Sometimes we forget to ask for guidance. We want wisdom, but guidance is the part of wisdom that we can't have. God has it. He sees above. He sees from where He is and can see all aspects of our lives. He guided the Israelites. Let's look at a couple of Psalms on that score. Psalm 78, an example of God's guidance. The time of the Exodus. Of course, we're leading up to Passover, so this is certainly apropos. Verse 51 talks about how He destroyed the firstborn in Egypt. And then in verse 52, but He made His people go forth like sheep. They walked out of Egypt and guided them in the wilderness like a flock. Now, we're not talking about the Sinai yet. They still haven't crossed the Red Sea. And He led them on safely so that they did not fear, but the sea overwhelmed their enemies, in verse 53. He guided them in the wilderness. Remember, they were entangled in the wilderness, is the way I think it's described in Exodus. Where God led them out of, from their Exodus at Sukkot on the night to be much remembered, He guided them down to the banks of the Red Sea, and the Egyptians thought they were pinned against the water, and so they came. Hot and heavy with their chariots to destroy the Israelites and to capture as many as they could as slaves again. But God was waiting for that. God guided them to that spot specifically because He was going to execute judgment on the leadership of Egypt. God guided. He could see. Psalm 23, the Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want. He makes me to lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside the still waters. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil. Thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me, etc., etc. God is our shepherd. Literally, Christ is our shepherd. You know, He's the head of the church. He is shepherding us. We need to pray for that guidance. What is a shepherd supposed to do? He guides his sheep. Why? Because he knows where the best grass is and where the watering holes are. He knows where the dangers are and guides them away from the dangers. A shepherd is a guide for the sheep. And that guidance is vital. We need to ask God to shepherd us through these troubling times, personally and in our families and in the church, to guide us through the things we can't anticipate because we simply can't see them. God can see them, and we need that direction. Proverbs chapter 3 is very famous. It's verses 5 and 6, very famous. Trust in the Eternal with all your heart and lean not on your own understanding. In all your ways acknowledge Him and He shall direct your paths. To direct our paths is to guide our paths. Directing us around the obstacles that we wouldn't know about. So we need to trust. You know where it says trust in the Lord and lean not on your understanding. Trust and lean go together. So in a sense, it's lean on the Lord. Lean on Him to guide us. Stay that close to where you're leaning on Him, spiritually in that sense. Acknowledging Him in all your ways, thus praying for wisdom and for guidance that He would direct us. Notice in Isaiah, talks about how great a guide God actually is for His people. Isaiah 28, it's a section, starts in verse 23 and goes through verse 29. Give ear, in verse 23 of Isaiah 28, "Give ear and hear my voice, listen and hear my speech. Does the plowman keep plowing all day to sow? Does he keep turning his soil and breaking his clods? Does he just keep plowing, plow and plow? I'm going to plow today." And then 5 weeks later, "Oh, I'm going to plow some more today, same field." No, of course he doesn't. "When he has leveled its surface, does he not plant or sow the black cumin and scatter the cumin?" Cumin is a tiny, tiny little grain that has nutritive and flavorful values. "And he plants wheat in rows, scatters the cumin in a broadcasting way, and then he plants the wheat in rows, and the barley in its appointed place, and the spelt in its place." So he has these different places that he plants the things. Doesn't throw the cumin in with the wheat or the wheat in with the barley, because they get ripe at different times. "For he instructs him," God instructs him, man, "in right judgment. His God teaches him. For the black cumin is not threshed with a threshing sledge." You don't thresh the cumin seeds. They're too tiny, like you would thresh wheat or barley or spelt. "Nor is a cartwheel rolled over the cumin, but the black cumin is beaten out with a stick." Presumably, you take the stalks and you beat on them with a stick. That's similar to the way wild rice is harvested, which isn't technically rice at all, but it's the seeds of that particular plant in Minnesota and other places where it grows naturally. And the way the Indians harvested it is the way it's still harvested by some. You get a canoe and you paddle into the marshes and you lean the ripe stalks of the wild rice plant over into the canoe, and then you beat on them with a stick. Just knock off all the ripe seeds. And then you move forward and you get another batch and do the same thing. Well, the cumin, is used a stick for doing a similar kind of work. You don't grind it down with the wheel, that with the ox going around and around in a circle. "Bread flour must be ground," in verse 28, "therefore he does not thresh it forever." I mean, if you're going to make bread, you don't just keep threshing it and threshing it and threshing it. You grind it in the flour so you can cook it and eat it. "He doesn't break it with his cartwheel or crush it with his horsemen. This also comes from the Lord of hosts." What do you mean it also comes from the Lord of hosts? God gave man enough sense and guidance to make sure that he understood how to harvest the food that he planted. Practical things indeed. "This also comes from the Lord of hosts, who is wonderful in counsel and excellent in guidance." Somebody had to learn how to harvest the grains. But God guides in lots of other ways. Like I said, often God guides when we don't know what's coming and the dangers ahead. And that's what we're concerned about right now. Winston Churchill, during the days of World War II, which was a time of great disaster after disaster in the early part of the war for Britain in particular, some degree for America, but especially for Britain. But then there were times which prevented complete disaster. And Winston Churchill had a saying that he sometimes said, "Sometimes I have a feeling of great interference." That was his way of saying divine intervention. Is great interference. God was guiding things and moving the part of the British Navy here and part of the British Navy there. Even though they had some defeats, they were still preserved. Even though they were threatened with disaster in the Battle of Britain, the air war, they were preserved. God guided things. We need his guidance for us and for his work. Finally, we need to pray for protection. Back to Proverbs. Praying for protection is wisdom itself. Back to chapter 3, in fact, verse 19. Proverbs 3:19. "The Eternal by wisdom founded the earth, and by understanding he established the heavens. By his knowledge the depths were broken up and the clouds dropped with dew. My son, let them not depart from your eyes. Keep sound wisdom and discretion, so they will be life to your soul and grace to your neck, and then you will walk safely." Oh, if you seek God's wisdom, you will walk safely. Pray for protection. A great deal of protection comes from having prayed for wisdom and guidance. "Then you will walk safely in your way, and your foot will not stumble. When you lie down, you will not be afraid, and when you lie down, your sleep will be sweet, because you know that you're being watched over by God." and because you have been wise and have sought the wisdom and have taken appropriate measures like locking your door, things like that, to be sleeping well. And do not be afraid of sudden terror. The world is afraid of that. We need not to be. Nor of trouble from the wicked when it comes, and it will. For the Lord will be your confidence and will keep your foot from being caught. We live in times when we need God's protection. But a lot of that protection comes from having already prayed for wisdom and thus for guidance as well. Notice Psalm 18. Talks about God's protection there too. David knew that he needed, you know, as strong as David was, and David was very strong. Now, he killed a bear up close and personal. I'm not sure how he killed the bear. And that is escaping me at the minute. They had bears in those days in the Middle East. And they were sizable bears. They were larger than our black bears generally from what I have read, and not as big as our grizzly bears, but they could be just as cantankerous at times. He also killed a lion. They came after his sheep when he was a shepherd. Remember, he's talking about killing a bear and a lion and how he grabbed the lion by his beard or his mane and he struck him. It appeared to be he struck him with a knife, I would presume, but because I don't know what kind of club you would use to knock a lion senseless. Unless you were really strong, and you would have been one phenomenal baseball player. Make Mark McGuire look like a wimp and Barry Bonds like a weakling. And David, maybe David was. He was very strong. But David was always asking for God's protection anyway. He knew that his strength wasn't all there was. Verse 30. We begin. As for God, his way is perfect. The word of the Eternal is proven. He is a shield to those who trust in him, all those who trust in him. He's a shield. In other words, God throws the shield up to protect us. For who is God except the Eternal? And who is a rock except our God? A rock. It is God who arms me with strength. David knew that's where his strength came from, physically and spiritually. Excuse me. And makes my feet like the feet of a deer. Sometimes strength is in run away. Get away from the danger. And sets me in high places. He teaches my hands to make war, so that my arms can bend a bow of bronze. I used to read that, and because we started with an archery article, I thought, well, their bows were made out of wood and fiberglass. A bow of bronze. I know that there were bows made of spring steel. Crossbows used those. And they were fierce. But I had no idea that you could make a bow of bronze till I commented on the scripture once in the hearing of Dan and John Miller, two brothers up in our Cambridge, Ohio congregation, who are tool and die and parts manufacturers. And they make a lot of parts out of spring bronze. I had no kidding. So one of our projects is to make a small crossbow out and have a bow of bronze on it so we can experiment with how in the world did you have a bow of bronze. And it had to be a phenomenal bow. And I've often thought, well, what was the advantage of a bow of bronze? I know that in India, having read antiquities of archery there, they had steel bows. And the beauty of the steel bow is it was left strung all the time and it didn't hurt it. It wouldn't take a set. Wooden bows have to be unstrung. Even composite bows, when you use them, you have them strung to shoot the arrows. But when you're done, you take the string off so the bow can relax and wait for the next time. But when the next time comes, if you're in a really big hurry, your bow is unstrung. Now, I am sure that there were some people that learned how to string their bows fast, but if you wanted a bow immediately in action, then you had to have a steel bow or a bow of bronze. So we have a project. It's a sort of experiment to see what the bow of bronze's capabilities were back in the day and understand this prophecy. But it talks about being ready, on top of things, a minute man. For us, there's a spiritual application. We're not going to be fighting the wars of this age. Those aren't our battles. Our kingdom is not from here. If my kingdom was from here, Jesus said in John 18:36, then my servants would fight that I should not be delivered to the Jews. But my kingdom isn't from here. These are not our wars. We don't fight them. We fight spiritual wars. And so the bow of bronze is an analogy of immediate readiness, and God is the one who gives us the strength to pull it. In Psalm 91, God will protect, but we must ask Him to protect. Psalm 91, beginning in verse 1. He who dwells in the secret place of the Most High shall abide under the shadow of the Almighty. And that's where we want to be, is under God's shadow in that sense. I will say of the Eternal, He is my refuge and my fortress, my God, in Him will I trust. Surely He shall deliver you from the snare of the fowler. And how does God deliver us from the snare of the fowler to understand the snare of a fowler, it was a snare that was set to catch birds. That was in the age before shotguns, when getting birds was a little on the tricky side. So they sneaked out when the birds were roosting or where they would set traps to capture them. And snares were one of the ways they did that. Actually, snare of a fowler would be often put on a post or a branch. And when the bird landed, it was a spot where birds were known to land. When they would land, the little wire or cord would be tripped and it would catch him by the feet. And then you come along and collect him and take him home to dinner. He probably doesn't want to go home to dinner with you. But that's tough. He's a bird. But we don't want to be caught by the feet, taken home to dinner that we don't want to go to. You know, we're not birds. But God will deliver us. So how does He deliver you from the snare of the fowler? Well, sometimes that comes from guidance. You're not going to go there. God uses the Jedi trick, you know, from Star Wars. I think I'll go here instead of there. Why did I decide that? Then you find out, well, because this was the safe place to go. That was dangerous. You were just deflected. Sometimes His intervention is like that. He guides us. Sometimes, which way am I going to go? Oh, that doesn't look good. I'll go there. Go where it's safe. Where we should go. Where righteousness dwells. You see, because we've been given wisdom. And we've asked for the wisdom. We asked for the guidance. And even so, we still need the protection. Surely He will deliver you from the snare of the fowler and from the perilous pestilence. Ooh, okay, we can understand that. He will cover you with His feathers, and under His wings you will take refuge. We're going to be protected by feathers? Protected? You mean like protection protected by feathers? Actually, yes. Remember when Jesus said, it's in Matthew 23, right at the end, He was lamenting to Jerusalem, how Jerusalem, Jerusalem, how I have longed to gather you under my wings like a hen gathers her chicks. And under the mother hen's wings, the little chicks are protected. They aren't visible to predators. They're protected from the weather. The wings are marvelous as far as shedding water and things like that. They could protect it from hail. And she might not be as well protected from the hail if it's large, but the baby chicks, they're much more fragile. Oh, yes, being protected under God's wings, that's a good thing. He will cover you with His feathers, and under His wings you will take refuge in truth. His truth will be your shield and buckler. We have God's truth in the church of God, and it is a shield. A buckler, all right, the difference between the shield is big. And in big and round like this, or the Roman shield was about 4 feet long and I think about 30 inches wide. Maybe it's a little wider than what it actually was. But that was for defending as a shield wall, working as a team. A buckler, on the other hand, is a tiny shield that maybe is big around as a basketball or smaller. And it was worn, it was in the opposite hand, the left hand, when the sword was in the right. So it was a battling shield. And it was used to deflect the other man's sword away from you. That's the whole purpose of a buckler. So it was a shield that was used for, you know, a tactical shield. The other one's a strategic shield. Either way, God's truth serves as both a shield and a buckler. It can deflect away that which is dangerous, and it can protect like a wall. And you shall not be afraid of the terror by night, nor of the arrow that flies by day, nor of the pestilence that walks in the darkness, nor of the destruction that lays waste at noonday, And the next verse we'll see happen when really sad times come. 1,000 will fall at your side and 10,000 at your right hand, but it shall not come near you. Only with your eyes you shall look and shall see the reward of the wicked. And that's because you have made the Lord, who is my refuge, even the Most High, your dwelling place. No evil will befall you, nor any plague come near you, near your dwelling. For he will give his angels charge over you, in verse 11, to keep you in all your ways. And in their hands they shall bear you up, lest you dash your foot against a stone. Whoa, we've heard that one before. Yes, that's a prophecy of Christ, of Christ's Messiahship, was verse 12. Bottom line, God will protect. Do not take that for granted. We have to pray for it. And not just for ourselves or for our immediate family, but for all of God's people, for the church and for the work of promoting the gospel. Wisdom, guidance, and protection. Now, finally, we end with a small example, a short prayer that was prayed in the early days of the church in Acts chapter 4 that embodies this prayer. Acts chapter 4. Peter and John have been arrested, and they ultimately get released. And in verse 23, and being let go, and suddenly they're seeing what Christ has said. They aren't going to like you. They're going to persecute you. Well, being arrested was a type of persecution because they would keep telling him not to preach in Jesus' name anymore. And being let go, in verse 23 of Acts chapter 4, they went to their own companions, that is the brethren, and reported all the chief priests and elders had said to them. So when they had heard that, when everybody heard that, all the disciples, all the brethren heard that, they raised their voice to God with one accord. Now, I'm not sure what that means, they raised their voice. Did the apostles raise their voice in a prayer that they all just sort of were inspired to know at the same time? It was an audible prayer. It was out loud. Or did they all? I mean, everybody that heard their report simply spontaneously pray this prayer. I think there was some guidance. I don't know at what level. There was some intervention here, for certain. But notice the prayer. Lord, you are God, who made heaven and earth, and all the sea, and all that is in them, and who by the mouth of your servant David have said, so they looked at God's greatness as creator, and through your servant David have said, and this is, I think it's Psalm 2, why did the nations rage, and the people plot vain things, and the kings of the earth took their stand, and the rulers were gathered together against the Lord and against his Christ? So the nations were angry. They opposed God. For truly, against your servant Jesus, whom you anointed, both Herod and Pontius Pilate and the Gentiles and the people of Israel were gathered together to do whatever your hand and your purpose deemed before to be done. That had to be done. Now, look on their threats. We are facing danger. And grant your servants that with all boldness, now boldness is going to require wisdom, that with all boldness they may speak your word, and by stretching out your hand to heal. So God would intervene to guide their preaching, using wisdom to be bold, guide their preaching, and to intervene specifically to protect either from disease through healing or with signs and wonders that they may be done through the name of your holy servant Jesus. This is a powerful, phenomenal prayer. And they essentially, when you look at what they were facing and what they're asking for God to give them wisdom and for God to guide them, you know, considering the troubled times they lived in, and thirdly, to ask God to give them protection so that they can move forward to do his work. And when they had prayed, the place where they had assembled together was shaken, and they were all filled with the Holy Spirit, and they spoke the word of God with boldness. Well, brethren, that's what the church needs to be able to do now. Speak God's word with boldness and be heard by a society that doesn't really know God and desperately needs to. And there are disciples out there that need to be made. And the church needs to grow in that sense, but the witness has to be carried to the world. We need, at a personal level, as well, therefore, as at the church level, we need to pray for wisdom, guidance, and protection.